This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I have a feeling we're about to embark upon a most unprecedented expedition.
G'day everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Stacey and Elliot's
Bogus Journey.
I am your host Stacey, and I'm here with Elliot, my buddy, and we're going to pivot a little for the next few episodes of the Bogus Journey. The Place to Be Nation is organizing the greatest WWE wrestler ever list. It's everywhere. There's a Facebook group where all the discussion is being had. There's a lot of podcasts coming out about certain candidates, and I encourage everyone to get involved with it if you haven't already. So for the next few episodes of The Bogus Journey, we're going to keep doing what we're doing, which is looking at some of our favorite matches and favorite wrestlers and analyzing them, but also then talking about the wrestlers themselves as candidates for the greatest WWE wrestler and deciding what we're thinking about, if we're going to rank them, where they're going to rank them, and what people can sort of look at as far as their candidacy goes. So how you doing, Elliot?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Happy to be here. Ready to talk some WWE matches. You know, I'm like the weirdest wrestling fan ever, and that I'm a hardcore wrestling fan, but I'm like as casual a WWE fan as it gets. So there's a lot of people that I need to look at. We've got a good show, I think, coming up today. Excited for some matches. We're actually kind of deviating even further from our normal format in that you actually got three matches this time.
I do, yeah. I'm cheating a little bit. But in my defense, they are short little squash matches. So in time, it probably all adds up to be the same anyway, same as your match. But
and in my defense, I picked a 2 out of 3 false match.
Exactly. So it all evens out, I think. Yeah, so today I wanted to look at a little series, like I said, of squash matches between Drew McIntyre and Trent Barretta. These happened at the sort of the end of 2010, start of 2011. And I like to look at them as a whole series because they're just a little series that they had together. And I absolutely love them. Like, they're some of my favorite squash matches ever.
This is the series that you're using to convince me that Trent Barretta belongs on the list, right?
Well, I should really. I don't think he's even been nominated.
I had never heard of him before you told me about these matches.
Well, you should watch some Trent. I like Trent Barretta as well. But I mainly use them to sort of show what Drew McIntyre can do or what he could do during his first run at WWE now that he's back again. Yeah, I always liked Drew Mac ever since he first came in. And it was around this time, maybe sort of earlier in 2010, that he started getting really, really good. And it's a good indication, I guess, of what he could do, because he has this, like, a really squash match with a guy like Trent, who is small and can bump around for him. And Drew just, like, mauls him so much. You know, like, the more violent Drew got, like, he got more violent as his career went on in WWE, and by the end, he was just such a great badass heel with such great offense and would just, like, kill guys in the ring. And that's really what I loved about him the most.
And that's exactly the sort of guy that obviously I'm going to like, somebody that just mauls people and works really stiff. I'm not super familiar with Drew McIntyre's run. I'd seen a couple of the matches with Chris Masters during GWE just to kind of watch him. And then I watched some of his longer indie match stuff after his first WWE run, and I actually really liked it a lot. So he was somebody that I actually had wanted to spend some time watching for this project just to kind of get a better idea of sort of what he could do. I knew it was all going to be, you know, I knew there wasn't going to be like an epic, you know, 5-star main event pay-per-view match or anything like that, just because that's not the opportunity that he got. And you know, those guys deserve a fair shake in this project, because not everybody gets booked to the main event. But that doesn't mean that they don't do quality work. So I'm glad that Drew is kind of the guy that we really got started with in terms of looking at guys for this project, because he's one of those guys where I love that he got to just go out and maul people and work really stiff, because he doesn't really strike me as overly charismatic. He's not huge and he's not small. So he's kind of in that sort of like weird in between like size range. And then without the sort of like amazing charisma, it was going to be sort of hard for him to really stand out in this world of like really big personalities and, you know, monsters and little guys, or just, you know, in the wrestling world. And, so a good way for him to stand out is to just go out and maul the fuck out of people. And that's what he did in these matches. And it was great. I think there was in the second match, there was a chop to the face, and it was like a chop or a backhanded slap, but either way, like I just threw my hands up in the air when it happened. Like, oh my god, like that was nasty. So yeah, that's the exact sort of thing that like I want out of a short 3 minute, 4 minute long TV match. It's just one guy just mauling the other guy. That's great.
Yeah, like if I had to sum up Drew Mack in one sentence, I would just say he chopped Trent Beretta right in the fucking face.
Yeah, I mean that's like that gets somebody on the list.
Exactly, like because I remember watching the match live, and that was my exact reaction. Like I was like, holy shit! And then I went online and was like, he chopped him in the face, like on WWE TV. You know what I mean? Like you don't see that shit. Like you see it a bit more now as guys get stiffer and stuff. But like back in 2011. It was like, holy shit, someone just chopped a guy in the face on SmackDown. Like, you never see that. And it just, oh, it blew my mind. It's so good.
My notes for that moment were chopped to the face, holy fuck, stop the match. Like, they could have just stopped it right there, and I would have been fine.
There was and that's, if you hear the commentary, I don't recommend that you listen to the commentary in any of these matches, but after he did that, like, whoever was sitting there, like Josh Matthews, I think, was sitting there going, oh my god, like, the ref should stop this. Like, that's what he literally said after he saw that. It's like, oh my god. Yeah, it was so good. Like, and even the other stuff great. He was doing to him. Like, the first one was the 31st of December 2010.
Yep, because he beat him, and then at the end, he you know, hit the double arm DDT on the outside. And then he was talking shit to him. He said, Happy New Year.
Good job, kid. Happy
and he
New Year!
Him, and he walked off, and that's fucking great. Yeah, yeah. That was New Year's.
So yeah, like so even like because I agree, he never had a lot of like charisma in his first run. Like because when he came in, I think he was like they called him the chosen one, and that he had Vince's backing, and he was going to get a big push and everything, and it never really worked out like that. And I think it's because he really didn't have a lot of overt charisma, and didn't really like. He wasn't really on that level, but as he went, again, as he
it's
went
like
off,
Jeff Jarrett, the other chosen one.
Yeah, he got as far as Jeff Jarrett. But like, you know, but he also, like I said, as he went on and sort of developed his ring work and stuff, he did develop a kind of like little sort of like cocky heel stuff to go along with this like aggression, because he would do things like that. Like he like the first match ends when Trent drop kicks him to the outside, and then Trent does a flying senton over the top rope to the floor, and Drew gets out of the way. And he swanton bombs the floor straight over the top rope and kills himself.
Oh.
And Drew, like, it's so great when that happens, because Drew is standing there, like, he's actually shocked. Like, he's looking at that guy like, holy shit, he just killed himself.
Yeah, just he fucking slams on the floor.
Yeah, and then by the time like the ref calls it off and everything, Drew's laughing and he's like, "That guy just killed himself," and then picks him up and DDTs him on the floor just to be a dick.
And then tells him Happy New Year.
Get Happy New Year.
That swanton to the floor was nuts. I had no expectation for it whatsoever. Did not see it coming.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my god! Like.
Trent in his little WWE career was actually like really good as that kind of small babyface who would just fly around and dive on things and like kill himself for bumping and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, like Trent wasn't bad. He just never really got anywhere.
Yeah.
He actually died.
Drew McIntyre killed him. no one's ever seen him since. That Swanton. I mean, it was perfect. I was like, oh, it's so great. And then I was like, wait, Drew's not there. Oh, he's dead. He's a dead person. How are there two more matches?
No longer alive. Well, his ghost, you know, comes to
his ghost, yeah.
For revenge.
Well, his ghost got chopped in the face.
And his ghost got chopped in the face. Yes, he was very, like, a very solid ghost, obviously. He, you could hit him. But, yeah, but even the things that happened before that, like, when Drew, like, picks him up and, like, does a big buckle bomb, like, just power bombs him into the corner, which was, like, so much better than any buckle bomb Seth Rollins has ever done.
That was nasty. Just ridiculous. And then he did a couple belly to bellies into the corner too.
Yeah.
But that powerbomb was absurd.
See, and even like even in the second match, even just the way he like threw him outside to get outside where they did the slap, like he literally just like picked him up by the hair,
yep,
the apron, and just like drove him into the floor.
Yeah, I wrote that down too.
It's just so brutal. Just these, like the clotheslines he would throw was so brutal and hard. Like, just everything, you know. Like, so that's what Drew Mac was doing. Like at this period, like this is sort of the start of when he started getting good and started like ruling over the C shows. And anyone who's watching the C shows in like this time period knows that they were like a highlight of TV, and there were so many good matches on Superstars, on Main Event, you know, around these years. And so, yeah, and Drew Mac was really, really good on them. And this is how he would just brutalize people just so bad. Like, there was a huge-ass big boot that he did. And even when he would put holds on, like, there weren't a lot of holds in these matches because they were so short, they were just squashes. But, like, even when he was, like, working a headlock, he was, like, leaning back and bridging, like,
yeah, he would do the regal, put a knee on your head while you're in an arm lock.
Yeah, he just, everything he would do in the ring was just so like hard and so snug and stiff. It was just a joy to watch because he would make anything look good, and especially when he has a guy like Trent who would just bump his ass off for all of it. Oh yeah, like I love there's a great sort of little conclusion, like, because the first match ends when Trent dies. The second match, Trent comes back for revenge, and he does get chopped in the goddamn face, but he also rolls Drew up and pins him and gets...
And that was great, too, because it was... So the second match was all, like, for whatever reason, I guess the fact that Trent, like, attempted offense against him in the first match. And the second match, Drew was just fucking mad. Like, so he came out really big.
Well, like, Trent came out mad as well. Like, Trent came out mad for revenge, and Drew was so completely offended that he, you know...
That he went over the top. Yeah, he, you know, he got that boot in the face, he did the, you know, ripping him off the apron by the hair, basically, and making him bump to the floor, and then the chop to the face. So, like, he was super aggressive the whole time. You know, Trent's only, like, real offense was he got the... like a reversal of a German on a backflip, and then he hit like the Kenta knee for a two count.
Yeah.
And the fact that he got a two count just, you know, destroyed Drew.
Drew was like, fuck this shit.
He just fucking snapped. So then he, you know, he does the awesome belly to belly to the corner, and he's just like cocky and, you know, ridiculous bump. Looks like he could have ended the match right there. But he just like, you know, he gets this look, he kind of sees the side of the ring where Trent tried to dive on him before in the first match.
He looks out to the floor where you could see Trent's chalk outline on the floor still.
Yeah, exactly. and so Drew decides that he's going to throw him right into the chalk outline. And
kill his ghost.
Kill his ghost again after chopping it in the face. And so he's cocky and he's overly aggressive all at the same time. And that you know, leads to Beretta rolling him up on the press slam attempt and getting the win, which makes Drew just even madder. So I thought that was a great just little bit of storytelling where, you know, he used, you know, Drew was just over aggressive the whole time, and that kind of came back and bit him in the ass at the end by like the, you know, quirky little roll up by the smaller guy. You know, it's just like good basic wrestling psychology.
Yeah, and that's and it's why it was such a fun series to watch, because it wasn't just that they were squash matches, like there was an actual story from A, B to C. Yeah. Then they come back because there's the last match as well on the 21st of January, and again, like Trent, you know, runs around him and tries to get these dives on him, but then like he would like jump and Drew would just like catch him in midair and Batista bomb him and shit.
Yeah, there was no fucking around in that one.
No, and then Drew just goes up to like to the top and does like the angle, like throw him off the top rope thing, and then he was just done. Like that was it. There wasn't even a finish. It was just that. Like he just hurled him from the top rope so badly that he was just dead.
Cole had a great line. Winning streak ends at one, which I left. That was great. That was good by Cole. Cole, not as bad as everybody thinks.
No. He's fucking terrible in this period, though. I hate heel Cole so much. So I was just trying to ignore the commentary during these matches. It was so bad. And then...
you know, there was the whole thing with Kelly, too. I did want to ask about that in terms of, like, Drew's character going forward and like how that affected him, because you know before the Drew's in love with Kelly, but she can't be with somebody who likes hurting people, which begs the question, why are you trying to date a wrestler? But whatever.
I thought that too. There was a little side plot with Kelly going on. Where basically Drew just liked Kelly, but Kelly didn't like him basically because he was a heel, you know what I mean? Like, that was the only thing, because she's a babyface. And then after, I don't know if you saw that, I think they showed a replay at the end. After the second match when Trent pinned him, Drew went backstage and, like, found Trent and just, like, slammed him into a wall. Yeah. And that's when Kelly came up and said, and, like, caught him, you know what I mean? And he acted like he was caught, you know what I mean? Like, she'd caught him doing something mean. And then she's like, I can't be with someone who enjoys beating people up. You know, you're going to have to date outside your workplace then, sweetie. But, but also, like, I sort of liked it in the sense that, like, when these things would happen, like, Drew, because, like, Drew, by nature, is just such a shithead and just wanted to beat people up, and he was so nasty. But then, like, Kelly would, like, see him do that, and he'd act like his hand was caught in the cookie jar, and he's just like, oh, shit, no, I didn't mean it, like, you know. So again, at the end of the third match, when Drew tries to give Trent a handshake,
tries to shake his hand,
and Trent is a smart baby face, and is like, no, this is not going to end well for me, I'm going to hit you first. So then they start brawling, and Drew just beats the shit out of him, and then... Kelly comes out, and poor Drew's just standing there going, he hit me first, didn't you see it? Please, he hit me first.
But he did. I'm gonna defend Drew for a second.
Kelly just sees him beating someone up again. She's like, I'm fucking sick of this guy, like, you know, so.
I'm gonna defend Drew and say that it was a legitimate handshake. That was a handshake that was okay. We're done now. I will not try and murder you for a third time. Like, it's okay. And Trent, because he was sick of getting murdered, decided that, you know, he wasn't done with this, and he slapped him in the face. He had it coming.
But also, like, if Trent had actually shook his hand, he would have been a dumb babyface. So it's like the one time that the babyface is too smart to shake their hand. But then it just gets him killed.
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, then it wasn't a smart move. He should have shook his hand. this was a guy who just spent 3 weeks kicking his ass.
Either way, he's probably screwed.
Yeah, either way, he's screwed.
But yeah, so there wasn't a lot that happened in the Kelly thing beyond that.
So
didn't go anywhere.
My fear was that it was gonna, you know, if it continued, it would be like Drew would try and hold himself back in the ring to prove that he could just have a real match without killing people to impress Kelly. Where I just want to see him larrying the fuck out of people at this point.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't remember that ever happening. I know it must have gone on for a few more weeks, because a couple weeks later, when he had the 2-minute match with Chris Masters on SmackDown, which is fucking awesome, by the way. But during that match, like, it goes for 2 minutes, but like half of it's not even wrestling, because when the bell rings, Drew grabs the microphone and cuts a promo saying, like, "Keely, Keely, I know you're watching this. This one's for you." And then just goes in and, like, just beats Masters in, like, 60 seconds. And it's so fucking good. I don't know if you've seen that or not, but you have to watch that. I've got to find the link. It's so good. It's, like, the best 2-minute match ever. And half of it is promo. So good. But, yeah, and so I don't remember anything happening beyond that. I think they just dropped it eventually.
That's good.
As, you know, as they do.
As they do, yeah.
But it has given me an excuse to cut some promos in Scottish, so I appreciate that at least.
Yeah, there you go.
I should have had some foresight and just done like this whole period in Scottish, but
that's my... So this is pretty much a good microcosm of what Drew did. Would you say, is that fair? I mean, I know these are squash matches.
Yeah, but like I said, it's a good indication of what he was starting to do in this period, which is basically just beat the shit out of guys.
Yeah, and these like short kind of 3 to 7 minute long matches.
Yeah, he got longer matches mainly on Superstars.
Superstars, like, yeah. But even then, like, you're not looking at it. There's not like a 20-minute Drew McIntyre match out there, is there?
No.
In WWE during
on probably on pay-per-view, because, like, he did get, like, he had runs with the IC title, and so he would have had some longer pay-per-view matches, but they're not really,
That's not what this case is about?
Yeah, I can't remember a really, really good Drew Mac pay-per-view match. Like, to be honest, it was only, like, after that when he, it was, like, it was really only after he stopped being pushed that he got really good. So it's right. Like, it's just all on TV.
It's typical. It's,
yeah, basically, yeah. I did like it. There was a, on SmackDown, Drew had the Intercontinental title, and then he was getting into it with Teddy Long. He was feuding with Teddy Long, who was the GM of SmackDown, and Teddy ended up, like, suspending him and stripping him of the title. So they had this big tournament to crown a new champion, and it ended up in, like, Kofi versus Christian in this, like, epic babyface match for someone to win the title. And so they have this, like, epic long babyface match, like, work rate thing. And then finally Kofi wins, and he wins the title, and he's, like, over the moon, and Teddy gives him the belt. And then Drew Mac walks out in, like, this white suit, like a boss, and just hands Teddy a note. And Teddy reads the note, and he's like, oh, fuck. So he takes the title off Kofi and gives it back to Drew. And everyone's, like, so pissed, and Kofi's pissed, and Teddy's like, I can't do anything. Like, it's, like, read the note. Like, you know, like, and Drew just, like, smiles at everyone and just walks off, and I'm like, oh, that's so fucking great. That's such an asshole move. And, like, that was basically the best thing he ever did, like, when he was getting pushed.
That's awesome.
Like... But, yeah, he really shines, like, as the C-Show King, just beating people up. Like, as I said this so many times to you in private, but, like, there's a match he has with Rey on SmackDown, I think a couple months later after this, and Drew Mac ends up on his knees for some reason, and he just, like, lariats the shit out of Rey from his knees. He just sort of, like, leaps into it and just kills Rey, and it's just, like, the best lariat you've ever seen, and I'm just, oh, it's so good. So, yeah, he has a great match with Rey on SmackDown. Actually, a couple with Rey, and he has, you know, more great matches with Chris Masters and a lot of different ones during 2011, which is probably Drew Mac's best year of work. It was 2011. He did a lot of good stuff. And then he sort of ended up in the 3-man band with Heath Slater and Jinder fucking Mahal. And they sort of, yeah. So, like, he'd still, occasionally get, like, a long, like, Superstars match to sort of show his stuff. But he just became, like, a sort of a comedy jobber after that and eventually left. But yeah, but there was that period of time where he was the king of the C shows. And he was just so good and just so stiff and just brutal, and that's what you want out of a heel, you know what I mean? Like, he would just really just murderize guys, and that's what I like best about him, apart from being Scottish.
What? Intangibles, there you go.
They mean everything. Intangibles, he has a Scottish accent that I can mimic whenever I want.
That counts. So what do you think of his 2017 NXT stuff? Is that kind of, is that bolstering his candidacy for you?
Oh yeah, see, it's a good little, I'm so glad that he's back. Oh my god. And in NXT too, which is like exactly, like if you ask me what kind of like random C-show guys from 5 years ago do I want on NXT TV right now, like Drew Mack is like number one, and Chris Masters as well, but like, you know, we're working on that. But yeah, so glad Drew Mack is in NXT. And yeah, he's been really, really, really good so far. Like, he's definitely benefited from his indie run. He looks like more of a star. Like, he's finally sort of grown into his body and grown into, like, not his push, because he's, well, I guess because he's getting pushed on NXT, but like, he actually does look so much more like a star now than he did back then. He's sort of figured out how big he actually is, and he wrestles a lot bigger. Like, a lot taller, if that makes sense.
And he's
been having good matches on so far. Like, that match with, I think it was Oney Lorcan, like, who is the former Biff Busick, where they just beat the shit out of each other, you know, is just so good. Like, all the matches he's had on NXT so far have been just really, really good. And again, really, really stiff. And he hasn't lost any of that, like, stiffness about him, which is so great. And now I think he can sort of combine that with, like, being older and wiser and knowing how to project himself more and just coming off as a bigger star than he did before. So I have high hopes for his run in NXT and when he makes it back to the main roster for this time, this go-around. And he's still only young, so I mean...
Yeah, that was my next question. Like, he's a pretty young guy, right?
Because
he
started
in... He first showed up in 2007.
Yeah, and he was very young when he started. He was like 20 or 21.
He definitely looked real young. And like, I know what you mean when you're saying kind of, guy, he's 6'5". He's 32. He's 32.
32 now, wow. Well, okay, yeah. I figured he was around about 30. Yeah, so.
Wow, that's young.
And he's been wrestling for so long and he's still only 32. That's what I mean. Like, he's got such a body of work already, but he still has the time to, like, make it back to the main roster and really have another go at it. Really a whole other second career, I would hope. So, yeah, he should add to his case this year as well, which is good news for him. But, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the good things that he already had in his first run, which is the stiffness and the, you know, the nasty offense and stuff like that, he has kept, but he's just added so much, like, presence to his act now. I think he's going to do a lot better in this go around.
Do you see him as like, is he going to be in your top 50?
I don't know. Like I said, I just last night have started thinking about where am I going to put guys and start writing it down.
Right.
And on my first sort of grouping, I had him around in the 70s, but that's with a lot of spots free above him, if that makes sense. I'm just sort of like trying to put guys into tens.
That totally makes sense. We talked a little bit about the show before the show that we don't really want to rank anybody in the 60s.
I started moving guys up, so like the top 50 is filled up, and then there's just a gap between 60 and 80.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. Like
50 and 70, I should say. And then there's so many guys like in the bottom 10.
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, yeah, so like once I move everyone up and he'll move up for me, I don't know if he makes top 50, but he'll probably end up in the 50s or 60s.
In terms of being king of the C shows, how do you think he compares to like some of the other, you know, quote unquote king of the C shows, like maybe Goldust or William Regal? Or Chris Masters, like he's. Do you think he's like the top of that grouping, or just in that grouping?
He's definitely in that grouping. I think I see him as very lateral to Chris Masters.
Right.
I see them as very similar, having similar runs and similar, not similar strengths, because like Drew Mack is a heel and Masters' strength is as a babyface and with his selling and everything. But yeah, similar resumes, I guess, and. Yeah, so they'll end up very close together for me. I don't know who's going to go over who. Probably Drew Mack will be
little bit longer of a run, right?
Yeah, a little bit bigger. And again, he has stuff this year that's helping him as well, whereas Chris Masters is not back yet, fingers crossed.
And Chris Masters, his first run wasn't really, that's not really looked at super highly. Do you think that Drew Mack was, like, more consistent throughout his first WWE run? Or did he have that sort of, like, kind of growing pains period?
Probably a little bit. Like, Drew Mack wasn't really good in the first couple of years. Because, like, yeah, he first showed his face in 2007, I think you said. But, like, then he disappeared and came back. Like, he didn't really do much in the first couple of years at all. He only really started getting the push in late 2009, and like I said, he really wasn't doing much during that push, like, in terms of work. So it was only, like, about a year later, when they dropped his push, that he started getting really good. So, like, there's not much in his first few years. Chris Masters had way more of a push in his first run, you know, with the Masterpiece run.
Right.
I always liked Masters in that early run, and I don't think he was ever as bad as was made out. In the first run, he has a really good pay-per-view match with Shawn Michaels. He was really good in that Elimination Chamber. There are certain things. Even really late in that run, when he moved to SmackDown, he was having good matches on SmackDown for a bit just before he was released the first time. So, like, you know, I think early career, I'd probably give it a little bit to Masters, actually, just for having those kind of highs.
Right.
But, yeah, but they seem pretty lateral. And then, again, like, they start getting really, really good on Superstars and have very similar runs on Superstars. And like I said, maybe the tiebreaker is that Drew's come back and he now has an NXT run this year to bolster his case a bit. But yeah, he's definitely the tie. Like, guys like Goldust and Regal and stuff have a lot of main roster stuff.
Yeah, it's
to add to their case as well. Like, it's hard to find guys to compare them to. Like, because even a guy like Cesaro, who's sort of like a I like his under the radar work, but he also has a lot more Raw matches and pay per view matches and stuff as well. So it's hard to find other guys to compare them to. But I think, yeah, of the guys who really shined in this era, mainly on the C shows where all the work was being done. Drew Mack, I think, would be the best one. And I think there's a point to be made that, like, we're doing greatest WWE wrestler ever, and a lot of people are focusing on, like, the biggest guys and focusing on stardom and saying, he had a good run on top. Oh, he main evented pay-per-views. Oh, he won all these titles he had all these memorable moments and stuff. And, like, that's definitely a part of it, but I think also, you should also not forget about the guys who maybe don't have those kind of runs, maybe don't have a lot of, like, star-making moments or memorable moments, but who did put in the work and who did have a lot of really good matches, you know, because work rate is just as much a part of it as well. And you don't want those guys to be forgotten when they're doing such good work. So I think he's a good candidate in that area.
And that's,
people should definitely check him out.
That's sort of kind of what I was sort of beating around with all these questions. Because with the criteria that we have that the hosts of the project kind of want us to consider, and I'm not taking part in the Facebook discussions, but just, you know, from what we've talked about and kind of what you've told me about the Facebook discussions and then listening to Will's podcast, The criteria is interesting, and I guess it really does come down to, you know, what you personally value, because I look at somebody like Kane, who has a, you know, borderline 20-year run. He's got, you know, in theory, like, lots of memorable moments and big matches and things like that, but I kind of think they all suck. And so, you know, like, his WrestleMania 14 match against Undertaker, like, you know, that might not mean as much to me as something like this small little feud that Drew Mack had against Trent Barretta. So it's an interesting project, like, with the criteria that's in place, what's important to me personally as a wrestling fan, and, like, kind of what I'm looking for when I watch wrestling. And so somebody like Drew Mack or Chris Masters is the really interesting candidates to me for this project, because they're, you know, I kind of asked you in private messaging once, like, you know, what's a guy like that do without any memorable moments or something like that? And you wrote back like, well, to me, the Chris Masters matches are memorable moments. So that's like, there you go. That's sort of a point in his favor. But on the other hand, there's like the broader, what does memorable moment really mean? Like, you know, is it like just moments that are like part of the WWE canon that are going to show up in a video package 5 years down the line? So, you know, it's interesting. Just this whole project, I think, is really interesting for guys like Chris Masters, Drew McIntyre, and, you know, going back to, you know, folks like John Waltman or, you know, even like someone like Rick Martel. I think Rick Martel is like a really interesting sort of candidate. He's somebody that I've actually kind of watched a lot of in terms of this process, because, like, you know, it's WWE only, so I'm not allowed to consider his AWA work, his Portland work, his All Japan work. But, like, I've seen it, and I know it's great. So, like, when I watched a 1988 Rick Martel match in WWE, like, I know I'm watching a guy who's great, but, you know, I have to compartmentalize it down to WWE. So I've watched a lot of his matches, and I'm not seeing anything great, but I'm seeing a lot of solid, a lot of really good, you know, a lot of fun. And so that's hard to think about in comparison to somebody like Kane or somebody like Triple H, who has all the moments and all the opportunities, but they, you know, in my opinion, I think they suck. So they're interesting candidates, and, like, it, you know, Drew Mack is somebody that we kind of wanted to, like, shine a light on. So I know for you to, you know, get me to watch more, but also in, like, the broader sense, like, just so people don't forget about them in the context of, like, well, Bruno was a giant star, but, like, you know, his matches weren't that great. Or, you know, Hulk Hogan or Ultimate Warrior, you know, there's just, these TV matches, like, these throwaway TV matches, they are, like, they might not be memorable, but, like, they're important because they show you what kind of wrestler they are. And just when it's, you know, when like, you can't forget that. Work rate's part of the criteria, you know? So I don't want to see guys like that get forgotten, because I'm way more interested in, I guess, learning, like, you know, revisiting Christian or looking at Drew McIntyre or thinking about random Rick Martel matches than, like, okay, is Hulk Hogan or Steve Austin the bigger star? It's just, I don't think that's super interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's much more interesting, I think, to think about the work rather than, you know, yeah, rather than who was a bigger star or who had more of a push, etc. So, yeah.
Who got more opportunities, things like that.
Yeah, memorable moments. Because, I mean, we all know what the memorable moments are in
history. You can't argue them.
History, yeah, exactly. And so
you can't argue them. So it's just a list of facts.
It's not nearly as fun. But, and I said this on the Facebook board today when someone brought up China, is that I don't think I'm going to put anyone on my list who was a big star or had a big run without backing it up with good work. Like,
right.
I don't see the point in just ranking people based on stardom. It's lazy, you know? So I do want them to back it up with the work, because there are so many good workers in this company's history, you know? So I gotta put them all in, and it's, some of them are bigger stars than others, but yeah, I don't want to see a good worker left off just because the company didn't want to push him, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, or because Brutus Beefcake was a big star when they were a kid, you know?
Yeah,
like,
fuck that.
Yeah, fuck that. Like, who cares?
Yeah, so yeah, that's the way that we're coming at it anyway. And so, yeah, I definitely want to give Drew Mack a shout out.
And you know, all that said, that's not to say that, like, stardom and, like, drawing, to us, in a sense, that stuff does matter. Like, when I look at, like, the top tier on my list, it is people that were big stars and got the opportunities, but...
Oh, of course, me too. Like, because if someone has the whole package of all these, then they're going to be at the top. But
exactly.
When you get to the people who are maybe stronger in one category more than the other, you got to include the ones who are strong in work rate without stardom, as well as the ones who are big stars without as much work rate. You know what I mean? Like, you got to do it both ways, I think.
And I'd be much more inclined to vote for the worker than the star.
Yeah.
Just because that's, you know, that's who I am as a fan. You know, that's like, that's what I care about.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, and it's much more intellectually interesting to analyze their performance and their work rather than, like I said, just think about, you know, who had more of a run than who, you know, like, yeah.
Right. And then also to try and, like, draw comparisons. Because, like, you know, this is a sore list. You're ranking everybody in WWE history. Like, at some point, you're going to come across, there's going to be, a moment on your list where one guy is a bigger star and the other guy's a better worker. And, like, which one are you going to pick? You know, it's just interesting because of how the company operates, where, like, you know, work didn't really, you know, in-ring stuff didn't mean anything for huge swaths of time, you know, just large portions of the company's history, like, being a good worker, like, didn't matter. Now, you know, that's sort of flipped, and so it's a different era, and kind of like, now the better worker you are, the better chance you've got in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Just with the nature of, you know, fans and how they are and how the company reacts to them. So I'm finding it much harder than GWE, because of the stardom, because of the like stardom drawing factor and all of that. And sort of like, it's difficult comparing Hulk Hogan and Drew McIntyre, but they're both people I sort of envision on my list, but for real different reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I guess Hogan's sort of a bad example because he was, I do think he was a great wrestler. So we'll say like Billy Graham, who's probably gonna make my list and probably gonna be around where someone like Drew McIntyre might be.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah. Alrighty, well, we might take a break now, and we will come back with our second match, well, not second match, but the second half, where we go back to the early 90s and look at the Evil Clown Doink, which I'm very excited about. So we'll be back in a minute. You're on the Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. and on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed. We offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation. For our second match, we picked, or I picked, Doink the Clown versus Marty Jannetty from Raw. This is June 21st, maybe, 1993. 2 out of 3 falls. I probably should have looked that up. Whatever. I know it's
let you do it because I didn't have the date, and then you didn't have the date.
I wasn't looking at it.
It's fine.
June.
It was in 93, yeah.
It's definitely June. It's definitely 93. And, you know, it's a pretty famous match. It's 2 out of 3 falls. Really more famous for me. I had actually never heard of this match until the PWO yearbook projects that Good Helmet and Lost put together. And then I read about this match there and it's like, oh my God, like I have to see that immediately. It was kind of, you know, the thread, they kind of talk about it as Doink as traveling champion Ric Flair, against Marty Jannetty, which is actually a pretty interesting take on it. Doink gets the figure four in, he gets press slammed off the top rope, you know, he's working against a small up and coming babyface. It's like you're Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton if Ric Flair was a clown. I also wanted, you know, this match I picked for a few reasons. Number one, it's great. Number two, it's a great match with a clown, which I think is kind of, that goes in concert with a lot of my picks thus far for this podcast, oddly enough. When we talked about starting this, I was like, you know, so like, how much Yoshiaki Fujiwara have you seen? You know, and now, you know, oh, we're going to watch a lot of Shoot Style. And now it's like, Ken the Box, Doink the Clown, Horace Boulder.
We have wondered.
I've fallen apart completely. In the best possible way. But, you know, the other reasons I picked this are because, like we talked about at the top of the show, we wanted to do a more greatest WWE wrestler focused show. Doink is interesting because it's not a long, and it's Matt Bourne, you know, the great Matt Bourne. Doink's an interesting one because it's not a long run. When I first started looking at the list and looking at the nominees, he was somebody that I was like, oh, you know, I would love to, maybe he'll be like my 100. Maybe he'll be my personal pick because, you know, it's not a really long run in the company. And just, you know, there's got to be, there's that, like, I love it, but there's got to be more. Like, there's no way he's a top 100. As I, you know, alluded to earlier, I started putting some rough drafts and tiering things and just to sort of get an idea of what my list was going to look like. And that's when I realized that just like getting to 100 WWE guys was going to be pretty tough, with just so many people like Triple H or Kane or, you know, just awful people like that there was no way I was going to rank no matter what. Criteria or not, just I'm not giving Triple H a vote. And with only 300 and something nominees, like, you know, it gets tight pretty quickly. And so I kind of realized that, like, yeah, having a really awesome 1 year run, like, absolutely gets you consideration for the list. And then as I kind of decided that I was going to consider more character work and stuff like that, you know, Doink became like an absolute lock for me. Clowns are creepy. I mean, there's just, like, that's not even an argument. Like, clowns are creepy. So the idea of a heel clown in WWE is brilliant. And this was actually, like, 6 weeks after that Simpsons episode, Can't Sleep, Clowns Will Eat Me. So this is actually, like, a really great time period to debut an evil clown. There's really three times that you could have really, really debuted an evil clown. It's when It was released, right after this Simpsons episode, and then, like, you know, a year ago when people were dressing up like clowns and freaking people out on the side of the road, which, like, what the fuck was that trend? Did you hear about?
That's just crazy. Like,
that just gave me, as somebody who walks around a lot, like at night, and like walks home from work at night, like, that gave me way too much irrational fear.
I'm not even someone who is freaked out by clowns much, but if I run into a fucking knife wielding clown at night, like, fuck
off. You're having a heart attack. Yeah, you're having a heart attack immediately. So the clown already wins. So it's already got the psychological advantage. It's ridiculous, a wrestling clown on the one hand, and on the other hand, I think it's totally brilliant. Especially in, like, the kids era of WWE, where it's, like, totally cartoony. Like, having a creepy evil clown is great. I love it. And then the fact that he's, like, a legitimately awesome wrestler, and he's having a match like this that's, like, you know, essentially a world title style match where it's like mat work and, you know, it's just very traditional, but like, oh yeah, it's a clown. Like, fuck yeah, that's what wrestling's all about.
exactly.
You know, he's a great in-ring worker. You see it in this match. There's another great match with Mr. Perfect that I know a lot of people really love. But just really, he was about, like, a complex character and, like, kind of marrying that into his in-ring work, which was already excellent. So it was really impressive, like, what he was able to accomplish, like, being genuinely creepy and being able to play these psychological games, but then have, like, really good, like, traditional wrestling psychology at the same time. Like, it was just such a great character, great guy to play the character. And so, like, when I asked you, like, you know, what heel Doink have you seen, and you said none, I was like, well, this is the fucking match, because this is really all you need to see, because you get a taste of everything.
Yeah, like I said, I've seen really nothing of Doink, and it was, yeah, it did show me, like, exactly what, the kind of stuff he was doing, and it was so good. Like, even, like, I think my favorite part of the whole entire match was right at the beginning, when, like, the bell rang, and then Doink would, like, creep back into the corner and, like, beckon Marty Jannetty to come follow him into the corner. And Marty's just like, no, no, because some shit's going to go down if I go in there. But, like, every time he would just be like, come over here. You know what I mean? And it was so fucking creepy.
And he's kind of giggling the whole time.
Yeah, he's just, it's so creepy. And he's just like, you know, like, you can't go in the corner because something bad is going to happen to you. And so they would just draw it out. And every time he'd, like, try and tempt him in. And it's just like, no, don't go, you know. It was just so good. And just, yeah, so creepy and so different, like, you know, way to work. But it was so perfect for the evil clown to do that kind of, like, messed up shit.
And all the stuff with, like, the second Doink and the under the ring stuff, like, I thought they did such a great job of, like, working that into the match.
Yeah.
And just timing everything so well. And then also just, like, kind of playing on the psychology of that whole idea that there is a second Doink with, like, you know, Doink 2 runs out right when Doink 1 is, like, in trouble. And, oh, just side drain.
Yes.
Doink, the second Doink in this is Fabulous One Steve Kern.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
yeah, which is awesome, which I didn't know. I read it in the thread, and I was like, fuck yeah, Matt Bourne and Steve Kern is great. That's just phenomenal. Two great wrestlers. Yeah. You know,
they drew out the swap.
Like,
yeah,
they,
because yeah, he came out, and then he went under the ring, and then the crowd told Marty that there was one under the ring, and he listened to them and went to find him, but he couldn't find him, you know, and all this. And then Doink goes under the ring, and you think, oh, they're going to do the swap now, but then the same Doink comes out again. You know what I mean?
On the opposite side of the ring.
Yeah. But it was a fake ad, and it was still the same Doink. So sort of try and convince you that, oh, maybe he's not going to do it. And then he goes under again, and then the second Doink comes out, and you're like, oh, this time it's real. Like, you know, like you're like pointing at the screen, like, oh, that's it, you know?
What it was a psychological ploy to get Marty looking the one way, and Doink, the original Doink, was going to sneak up behind him and Pearl Harbor him, which is like kind of a logical spot. Yeah. And then this was like the Misawa Kawada reversal upon reversal upon reversal, just brilliant, because Marty saw it coming. He knew that Doink, the original Doink, was actually trying to fake him out. I think Vince even called it, like, oh, Marty saw him coming.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, then they sort of did the shoulder block. Original Doink got knocked out. And then second Doink, you see, drags him under the ring. And then they do the swap.
They dragged it out really, really well.
It's like really high concept stuff for this era of WWE.
Yeah.
If you, like, it's really amazing, and really just wrestling in general. There's an argument to be made. I'm not gonna make it, but that Doink is like one of the deepest and most interesting characters that WWE ever did. Especially like this heel Doink. Obviously, when he turned face and he was just a fucking clown, whatever. Like, there was no depth to it. But, like, there's so much depth to this this heel character, and he was able to do so much with it, you know, in this little one-year run. Just excellent. You know, like, the match is really, like, a traditional match at first. Like, it's lots of, you know, kind of basic psychological stuff where, you know, early on Doink's trying to lure him into the corner, but, you know, typically matches start with the babyface shine, which I can't believe I'm saying, because I hate that terminology. But
but it's true. Yeah, and like, and Marty,
it's true. And Marty did all the sorts of things that you would kind of see him do as a rocker.
That's what I was
going to
say.
It was all arm drags, crisscrossing.
But it's good because the Rockers like were fucking great for starters, but they also understood that they needed that shine in the beginning, you know what I mean? And they always were really good at that part. So like Marty as a single is still really good at like getting all that in early, showing off stuff before he gets, you know, yeah.
It's really good, just basic psychological stuff where, you know, it shows that Marty's like a step ahead. It shows that he's smarter than Doink. Doink's trying to play these mind games, but Marty, the baby face, he's not going to get fooled by it, but he's also going to be one step ahead. Like when they do the great crisscross spot, but Marty stops running the ropes and Doink keeps running the ropes. Yeah.
Like, Marty's like the smartest baby face of all time in this match, and it's just such a relief to see one finally be smart.
and that's kind of another reason I wanted to pick this match, because I did want to talk a little bit about Marty Jannetty, because he's another guy that's like guaranteed to make my list. He's going to be really, really high too, the more I think about it, because like I love the Rockers run. One thing I'm really interested in, and I made this point in my Sasha and Brett comparison, is that like consistency is really important to me, and like Marty was never bad, you know, and like part of that has to do with the fact that he wasn't around for 15 years to get shitty, but the reality is he was in the company for like 6-7 years and it was fucking awesome all the time. The Rockers run was great, the split up was great, the matches with Sean were really good. This match was really good. Like, up until 1994, Marty's a better candidate than Sean. Obviously, it totally changes after there. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that you know, Sean was turning heel for the first time, whereas Marty was a babyface, and in a lot of ways he got to continue on working tag matches, but he got singles matches too, and it was kind of easier for him to transition to a singles match wrestler.
Yeah, like as, yeah.
As a babyface, because like we said, this was sort of like him wrestling as a rocker in this first fall, whereas Sean had to go and try and do something else completely, yeah. And part of what being a heel was is not really doing flashy shit that's going to get the fans to cheer for you, and Sean's been doing flashy shit his whole career, so he's, I think that plays a lot into like that sort of lost period of Michael's career when he first turned heel. Is just,
yeah,
that,
I agree. Yeah,
he didn't
know how to work heel at first. Yeah,
yeah, and it was because he was doing something like he couldn't continue to work like a rocker because that was gonna get him cheered. Whereas Marty could, you know, he could keep doing that, and you know, when you pair him with a great wrestler like Doink, you're gonna get a really awesome match. So anyway, so, you know, Marty, I think, is, like, a really interesting guy. I hope he doesn't get overlooked because, you know, Sean left him in the dust. That's unquestionable. And, you know, he wasn't around after, you know, 1994-ish or something like that. And, like, you know, he'd show back up and it'd always be good. It really would. So Marty's a really strong candidate for my list. Oh, he was there till 1996. Wow.
Yeah, well, you'd get fired and then come back in quite a few times.
Yeah, and then come back. Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think there was a podblast on Place to Be Nation about Marty Jannetty. One of them was about Marty. And the main criticism that they made, and I kind of agree with it, is that, like, Marty never sort of was able to move beyond being a rocker. Like, even when he went singles, he was still looked like a rocker. He still had the music and he still worked like a rocker, which was good and still made for good matches as a single. But he also, you know, again, like, it was because he got fired and stuff as well, but even when he would come back and stuff, like, he never found his feet as a singles guy, like, beyond the rockers kind of thing, so, like, yeah. But it's still made for good matches anyway, because rockers matches are fucking good, you know?
Like, did Ricky Morton ever move beyond the Rock and Roll Express? No, and, you know, he shouldn't have. So, you know, I think
the perception of Marty, especially by the late 90s when he would come back, like, it's still, like, he was still sort of stuck in a previous era, I think.
Right, so yeah, yeah, absolutely. But what he did in his era was awesome.
Oh, yeah, no, totally.
And it lasted a long time. I get those criticisms. He's not somebody that I'm looking at as like a top 10 candidate or anything like that. But I, you know, he's somebody that I think should be a lock for everybody's list. Because he, like I said, he was never bad. And that's kind of what we're like, the fact that he never moved beyond being a rocker, like,
I think
you
it
know,
just gave him a ceiling in the end, like, along with all of his personal problems as well, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As somebody who's more focused on, you know, the work.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I don't really care. Like, I just, what I saw was just somebody that was always a great wrestler.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
So this was so that's kind of what landed me on this match was that, you know, it gave us the opportunity to look at Doink, who I think should really, really get a good, solid look at from people, especially as we see a lot of, you know, just a lot of consideration being given to guys who weren't around that long, but the perception is that they were around longer than they may have been because of how old we may have been when we watched them. but so... The reality is, like, I think a really great year should get you consideration for this list with, you know, considering it is 100 spots.
Yeah.
And Doink is just such a fascinating character. And just the way he combined his in-ring work with his character work was just great. And
absolutely.
Suited the era so well, you know, like, a lot of kids, so it's really easy to scare the shit out of some kids with an evil clown. So, I mean, that's always great.
Yeah. I can imagine, like, how many kids he gave nightmares to, like, as a heel. Like, yeah. Yeah, like I said, this is my first look at Doink, really, like, as a worker. And I was, like, I was very, very impressed with what he was doing and all the little touches he was adding. Like I said, and the little, like, creepy, you know, come here stuff and the mind games. And also just being an asshole as well, because like any chance he got, he would like pull hair and like, you know, yeah, all this sort of like, you know, asshole stuff. And I was like, oh, what a prick, you know, like, so he's very, very good at playing that character in the ring. I was very impressed, and I'm definitely gonna have to check out some more Doink and consider him.
I know the Mr. Perfect match is online. I'll find that link and I'll send it to you. Because that's the other one from 1993 that is, like, really, really highly regarded in terms of, like, being a great match in addition to the character work. But I would also recommend, like, just watching his, like, random squash matches as Evil Doink, because the character work is so great and it's always there. And I know that, like, you're somebody that is, that, like, you know, takes character work into consideration. In terms of, like, what makes a great wrestler.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly, like, using it in the ring. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly,
it's one thing,
yeah,
to
exactly,
cut a lot of good,
like,
promos and stuff. And, you know, or even do good character work in skits and stuff. And I love all that shit, too. But, like, also just the idea of, like, portraying your character in the ring as well. Like, I think it's very important. And it doesn't get done well often enough. So when it does, I'm like, yep, that's the good shit.
Exactly. And when there's, like, such depth,
yeah,
to it, too, that, like, makes it all the more impressive. So, like, that's why I you know, I see only, like, a year run. And Matt Bord did some stuff earlier, too, in the WWF, so at, in the 80s. So that'll definitely get him some consideration as well. But really, like, the Doink run is, like, what makes him a lock for the list. And I was thinking about what, like, when I was watching this match, I did, like, I've always been a big Matt Bord fan. I always liked him. You know, both as just as Doink, but then also his territory stuff as well. But God, when I was watching this match, I absolutely looked up. I was like, wait, when did Buzz Sawyer die? Because Buzz Sawyer would have been fucking amazing as heel Doink, as just a total psychopath. I'm happy with the way it worked out. Like, I think Matt Bourne was great, but I was like, what could have made this, like, truly psychologically damaging for people? And I was like, Buzz Sawyer.
It was played by an actual sociopath.
If it was Buzz Sawyer or Mick Foley, like, they just would have,
yeah,
taken it to such a dark place. Buzz Sawyer, because he's just consumed by darkness, and Mick Foley because he was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, the way it was still great.
Foley, like, as Mankind, I guess, like, he sometimes he does kind of come off that way. You know what I mean? Like a demented clown,
yeah,
because he's still like being so, like, gregarious and stuff, but at the same time, he's so dark and, like, fucked up on the inside. Like, so, yeah, I get that. I think that's a good what if.
Like when Foley was stabbing himself in the knee with a fork, like, imagine if he was dressed up like a clown. When he was doing, like, fuck! Or doing the mandible claw as a clown. Yeah, like, Foley would have been devastating in that role. Just from a psychological standpoint, I think, like, people would have been hospitalized. It would have been like that Ricky Dozen and Freddie Blassie match when Freddie Blassie started biting him and people were having heart attacks in the crowd. But yeah, and like I said, like, Marty too is another guy that, like, you know, it definitely, like, limited, like, being a rocker, like you said, it limited his ceiling, but, like, he perfected what he did, and in a lot of ways, he's almost like the C-show star of his time period, or at least the rockers were almost like the C-show star of their time period. Like, he was almost like Chris Masters on steroids, almost, in terms of his run, and, like, it didn't mean much to the company in a broader sense. Like, if the Rockers disappeared in 1989, I don't think any fewer people would have, I don't think anybody would have stopped watching the show.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, but they were the guys having the good matches.
But they were the guys having good matches, like, adding depth to the show, like, making it watchable.
Yeah, I'm super high on the Rockers. So.
Yeah. So Marty's almost like my test candidate for, like, how high can, like, a purely work rate, like, I don't want to say he doesn't have any memorable moments, because that's just patently untrue. Like, the turn,
yeah,
obviously is a huge moment. Like, even some, like, I think they,
well, like, even when he won the title off Sean, like, when he, you know,
when he won the title off
like
Sean,
that,
yeah,
yeah,
absolutely, yeah. So he's got some moments, but they're not very many. And it's really like kind of just in one time period, and he was there for, you know, years and years and years more than that. But all of those years were just, it was all great work. You know, it was all great work. Probably not a single great interview other than maybe the term. But I don't know that Marty was given a great interview. But, you know, so he's a good, like, test subject for, like, how high can a purely work rate guy get.
And in that sense, it's a good comparison back to someone like Drew from my era, who, again, is mainly just a work rate candidate and not much else. But, yeah, but there's definitely a place for those guys on the list, absolutely.
Yeah, I would hate for those guys to get lost in the voting for...
Yeah, they shouldn't.
You know, all the usual suspects.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I did want to say, I love the commentary in this match.
Yeah, me too.
It was... Because, like, you know what I'm doing. I'm trying to, you know, for a glimpse to the future, we're going to try and do a Trish show eventually before... for the project, and so I'm trying to watch all the Trish Stratus matches, and so I'm all the wrestling commentary that I'm hearing is like Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler in Trish Stratus matches.
Yeah.
So like,
so Bobby Heenan's a bit of a relief.
It's a joy. It is an absolute joy.
Oh, tell
I'm
me about
laughing
it.
At the jokes. Like, you know? I'm thinking they're doing such a great job of like putting over the, you know, the Yokozuna body slam challenge while still calling the match and putting over all the work. Yeah, it was a delight.
What a novel concept for announcing. Yeah, no, I'm the same because like I'm like you. I'm watching all these Divas matches all the time, and you just have to just almost block out the commentary because it's, you know, either ignorant or just gross, you know. So you just gotta.
Mostly just gross.
It's the worst part about watching women's matches, I have to say. But yeah, it was a joy to listen to Heenan. I like early when he called the Greco-Roman hair pull.
Oh, I laugh.
I love that line so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I, you know, and I know that that's like a standard issue Bobby Heenan line. Like he said that probably 10,000 times.
But like for someone like me who doesn't watch a lot of that era where he's on commentary, like that stuff's fresh to me, and I'm like, oh, that's so funny. Like,
yeah, I hadn't heard it in so long, and I heard it, and I laughed out loud. And then you know he had the joke later where like, oh, he's not the only clown that I know. And they're like, what? You know the other doink? And it's like, no, there's a clown sitting next to you, Savage. There's a clown sitting next to you, Vince. Vince, you're sitting next to me, Bobby. Just, it was great. I really enjoyed the interplay between the three of them. It was delightful. It was nice to be reminded of what, like, not horrifying commentary was.
Yeah, but...
If only for a little bit.
Yeah, a lot of it was refreshing to me. Like, the commentary was, and also... The fact that Marty was a smart babyface and figured everything out, and in the end, things got resolved. Like, they tried to do the fake doink finish, but then Savage came out and, like, showed the ref the fake doink, and then the ref reversed the decision. Like, that was so awesome because it was a happy ending, you know what I mean? It all got worked out at the end. He tried as hard as he could to, like, do all these shortcuts and win dirty, but then it all got figured out, and, you know, justice prevailed. And I just, compared to these days... where, like, the heels win every fucking match and, like, you know, nothing ever gets fixed, you know what I mean? Like, nothing ever gets resolved in a happy way.
Yeah.
And so, like, just even just seeing that, I was like, that's such a relief, you know what I mean?
Well, it's a series. They'll resolve it later. They'll do it later.
Oh.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the whole package.
Invested.
Yeah, the crowd is into it, the whole package. Of, like, the story of Doink and then the story of the second Doink and the, you know, and having three falls even and just all these sort of mini things coming together and then the happy ending. Like, it was a great total package of a match. Definitely. Yeah, and I was very impressed with both guys. Like, I know Marty's such a good worker, but Doink really impressed me with what he was doing and stuff. And so, yeah, that was really good. I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome match. And same thing with the Drew McIntyre. I mean, they're different, you know, obviously they're radically different comparing short TV matches to a long 2 out of 3 falls match, you know, 4 minute long TV matches to a 2 out of 3 falls match. But, you know, that was actually like three logically built matches, you know, so that they all made sense. One bled into the other. You know, it was good. I liked these matches as just like the dichotomy of like being able to accomplish things in one 2 out of 3 falls match that was long versus, you know, 3 short matches spread out over a couple of weeks. You got the kind of forgotten about wrestlers, forgotten about storylines. Yeah, these were good matches. And like, I'm glad you're definitely going to look at more Doink matches, and I'm like, I'm definitely gonna look at more Drew McIntyre matches, because like, you know, we've said kind of throughout, like, this stuff is important. Like, you know, it might not really be,
but it like, is like for us watching,
especially like, not in terms of like drawing money, but yeah, like for the sorts of fans that we are, like. You know, Ray Jr. is a number one contender for a lot of people for being the best TV match worker ever. So I do think, like, being, you know, the top C-show, the king of the C-show, like, that should matter on some level.
Yeah, and I think it matters to us because we're the ones sitting here every week, watching TV every week, watching all the C-shows, you know what I mean?
Right,
so if someone is doing good work on a C-show, you know what I mean? And you're watching it and enjoying it, like, that matters, you know what I mean? Because that's your enjoyment out of it. So, I no matter where it comes from, to me, like, if it's good work, it's good work. And this stuff is definitely good work.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, we will end it there and then definitely come back and hit you with some more episodes where we look at more candidates and try and figure out what to do with them and give matches as sort of, like, examples, I guess, of their work. And hopefully next time we come back, it will be with the Trish Stratus episode, which I'm so super keen for.
Trish is like my highest priority right now, because she's a lock for my list already. I just don't know how high.
Yeah, well, me too, brother. So
yeah,
yeah, we will be back with you very soon. Thank you, Elliot, for joining me once again.
Thanks, Daisy. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yep, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.